fact that we do have remarkable stories allows us to say, well, there is a real phenomenon really occurring, and it's what allows ufology to become imprinted on our popular culture. I mean, you can't turn on the TV or the radio or open up a magazine these days without at least one instance of aliens or flying saucers trying to sell us decongestants or soda pop or or appearance in sitcoms or dramatic series. Even CSI has had aliens as a theme on a number of occasions. So it's really part of our popular culture. And whether UFOs and aliens exist or not, it's such a prevalent part of our culture now that in some ways maybe it doesn't even matter. It's just allowing us to speculate about who we are and our place in the universe.
We also, in the same section, Exciting Decades, there's an account in there that you refer to as Sky Cleavage, First Canadian UFO Photograph.
Right.
Would you like to tell us about that one? That,
sure.
I found that one a really good story, too.
Right. This was back 2 years before that, into 1947, so this is not too long after the experience by Arnold and all of them, the classic Roswell crash and so forth. But July 10th, 1947, 5:30 in the late afternoon, there are individuals at Harmon Field, which is a U.S. Air Force Base near Stephenville, Newfoundland. Now, these, again, I have to emphasize this is at an Air Force Base. A number of people working at the base saw a silver disc-shaped object flying overhead at a fairly high altitude, but they were watching it, and they described it as being comparable in size to a transport aircraft. However, there was, of course, no aircraft that had been sent up in the immediate area, and you can just well imagine that an isolated Air Force base, you tend to know what aircraft were around. But as this object flew overhead, it left behind a trail about 15 miles long. So it left behind either the first contrail or the first chemtrail, depending on your perspective. And just by coincidence, one of the witnesses had a camera with them and managed to take a couple of photographs. And these photographs did make it into Project Blue Book, the American Air Force UFO analysis. It was investigated by the Army Air Force Intelligence, and it was of great concern to military officials because of what they described a perceived threat that Soviets may have been behind the appearance of the flying saucers over North America. Certainly if there was an unidentified aircraft over Newfoundland, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to the United States. Obviously, in order to spy on the United States, flights from Russia would have to pass over Canada. So the initial report on this case was filed by the Harmon U.S. Air Force Base intelligence officers later that month and did make it to the Pentagon, where there was some serious discussion. Wright Patterson discussed it. Chief of Staff of Intelligence discussed it. And the investigation report, which we have available now through the release of some of the Blue Book documents, says that the bluish-black trail seems to indicate ordinary combustion from a turbojet engine. The absence of noise and apparent dissolving of the clouds to form a clear path indicates a relatively large mass flow of rectangular cross-section and a considerable amount of heat. In other words, they had a good analysis of what they saw, they just simply couldn't explain it. They said that they knew of no American aircraft were to blame, and they privately concluded something of foreign origin split the clouds over Newfoundland. So you can just imagine, during the early days of the Cold War, something flew over an isolated airbase, American airbase, and there was no explanation, and they even have a photograph of it. So quite remarkable, and chances are that most Americans don't know about this case. It's not really covered in most books because it occurred in Canada, and without an analysis of cases that occur in Canada, you wouldn't have heard about it. And I would say that this is sort of analogous to the release of the British Ministry of Defense, which issued some information about some of the cases it had on file throughout, from the 40s into the 60s and on beyond that, just about a month or two ago. And in that are a number of reports of American servicemen, American pilots who had encounters with UFOs and flying saucers, which really hadn't been advertised before because they were buried in the British files and certainly not available in the American files to such an extent. In a similar situation, here we have an incident on a Canadian soil of an American Air Force or Air Force base that is a remarkable case that simply has no explanation.
That kind of goes along with the next one I was wanting you to talk about, the one that you referred to as Duck Duck. I thought that was an interesting title for incidences that happened near Goose Bay.
Right. Yeah, I called
just
it
a
duck,
sense
duck.
Of humor.
I called it Duck Duck Goose. because Goose Bay is a military base, or was a military base, that was part of the Dew Line in the early 1950s, part of NORAD. And again, this was actually in Labrador, which is now part of Newfoundland. At that time was a separate entity. But again, in the sort of north, far northeastern part of Canada, very strategic because a lot of aircraft have to go over this particular area on their way to Europe, especially from the American Midwest. So a very strategic base. And the number of sightings occurred at the Goose Bay area based from about 1948 or so into the 1950s. And a fascinating series of cases occurred on 1951 on September 14th in the evening, and this was listed in Blue Book, where technical sergeants and corporals watched on radar two objects on a collision course. The radar operators attempted to warn the objects of an imminent collision, and they were surprised to watch one avoid the danger by moving to the right upon their request, except that no aircraft were known to be in the area. I mean, this was on display on their radar systems for about 15 minutes.
Wow.
The most interesting case, though, happened earlier than that, 1948, when a high-ranking inspection team was visiting the base's radar facilities as part of a tour, looking at refueling and servicing and so forth. Because, again, this was part of the role of Goose Bay was servicing aircraft on their routes to Europe. During the inspection of the Air Force radar shack, the operator saw a high-speed target on his scope going from northeast to southwest with a speed that was calculated to be about 9,000 miles an hour. Now, this, of course, was of great concern because... The base personnel were very puzzled by this, and they wanted to look good in front of the inspection team, and yet they have this ridiculous object on the radar scope. The poor airman technician was brought to task. They really chewed him out for what must have been a mistake. But then the target appeared a second time, and the team, including majors, saw the target on the screen themselves. Now, of course, they dismissed it as being due to just simply poorly calibrated equipment. Now, the base was comprised of two separate parts. There was a Canadian side to the base and an American side of the base. They went over to the other side of the base to look at the facility and found that the radar there had also tracked the same object. And, of course, the inspecting officer just said, well, it must have been some sort of coincidence, and both radar must have malfunctioned at the same time. Now, they were ordered to make a report on the incident through intelligence, and it had been suggested the object was a meteor, but, of course, when they actually talked to the radar operators, they found that the object was tracked and it maintained a solid altitude of 60,000 feet throughout its flight, and they believe that this meant that it was not a meteor. What's curious is that the very next day, both radars again reported a strange object, but it was moving a little bit slower and was somewhat lower, about 45,000 feet, and this time they explained it away as high-flying seagulls. So, again, here we have remarkable things being seen by individuals working at air bases, in this case, radar operators, tracking objects on radar And the official word is, because there certainly couldn't be anything such as a flying saucer, it must have been a meteor or high-flying seagull.
That's awful, high-flying seagulls.
Very, very high-flying seagulls.
It just doesn't seem like, you know, to me anyway, that seagulls could fly quite that high.
No, no, of course. I mean, they were just reaching. But this reminds me of Alan Hynek, who was ordered by the Air Force during the time he was working for Blue Book to come up with any explanation at all for some of the objects, and pressed for an explanation of the cases in Hillsboro, Michigan, came up with the famous swamp gas explanation, and he never did live that one down.
Yeah, we still joke about that one today.
That's right.
And then this next one from your section called the 60s. This one, I feel, only because of the date that it happened, I feel kind of closer to this one, because this incident happened on my 9th birthday.
Okay.
It's May 20th, 1967,
yeah.
Falcon Lake. Now, you also have an interesting personal connection to this particular case.
Right. Now, of course, I'll date myself, but not as badly, I suppose, but I was also quite young at that time, so I didn't investigate this back in 1967. However, I happened to be friends with the son of the witness. In fact, we used to hang around together, ride our bikes together, and I have this vague recollection that at one point I came over to his place after riding our bikes, and there were a lot of people there, and he told me that his dad had been burned by an airplane or something like that. But, you know, as young kids, we just figured, yeah, well, that's what happens to grown-ups, and forgot all about it. Well, as the years progressed, I learned that this was a remarkable incident after all, and when I actively began investigating reports in the 1970s, I was reminded of this case, and because of my connection with the family, I went back and talked with them, and got a great deal of information. So the story is that in May of 1967, a man by the name of Stefan Michalek was doing some amateur prospecting in an area, what's called the White Shell, which is along the border of Manitoba and Ontario. Again, this is just sort of straight north of Minnesota. Not that far from the American border, actually, maybe of the order of about 75 miles. And he was doing some amateur prospecting. He was an engineer by trade, but he was fascinated with nature and trying to find some gold and silver, and there were some claims in the area, so he thought he would try his luck. And around lunchtime, he was chipping away at a rock to stop to have some lunch, and the area where this occurred is very rugged. There's bare rock upthrust. It's part of what's called the Canadian Shield, very large granite upheavals, and lots of trees. However, at this time, towards the end of May, not many leaves had erupted on the trees' branches yet. But around lunchtime, he was taking a break, and below him, in a valley, there were a number of beaver dams and some small ponds, and on the ponds were geese. And all of a sudden, the geese were startled by something, and they all took off en masse into the sky and were flying away. And he thought, well, I wonder what's causing this, because there are bears in the area, and he wanted to know if it was too safe to be in the area. Well, maybe he should have taken his own initial reaction as a guideline, because it wasn't a bear, but he looked up and he saw two reddish objects, saucer-shaped objects in the sky, moving towards the area where he was. He sort of ducked down behind a rock, and as he did, one of the objects descended down and appeared to land or hover just above a flat rock outcropping not very far away from him. And as it got closer to the ground, it changed from red down to orange, and eventually down to a silver metallic appearance. It looked like a classic Hollywood flying saucer. The other one flew away and was lost to sight, but he focused his intent on this particular object, which was not far away, maybe 150 feet away from where he sat crouched behind a rock. He had a very good look at it. It was about 45 feet in diameter. It was shaped like a disc with a sort of a turret on top from which came very, very brilliant light. After a while, a little door opened in the side of it, like an iris, like a camera lens will sort of open several pieces, making it larger in the middle. And he started hearing some sounds. He first heard some air, as if something was being expelled, like a generator, like an air conditioner, or a bellows. And then he heard some very high-pitched voices. And, of course, he figured that this must be some sort of American secret device or vehicle of some sort, because there's no such thing as flying saucers, really. And yet, there was this thing right in front of him. So, thinking that it was some sort of American vehicle, he walked up to it quite bravely and got within maybe 20 feet of it and called out, "Okay, Yankee boys, come on out and I'll help you fix your broken down airplane," or whatever it was. However, at that point, the voices stopped, and he realized, well, maybe they're not American. So he actually was from Europe and had been in the military in Europe and was multilingual. So he called out in Russian the same thing. "Come on out, I'll help you fix your broken or your object in need of repair." Still no reaction. He called in a few more languages. Still nothing. At this point, he was quite brave, walked directly up to it, and leaned on the side of this object with one hand and poked his head into the doorway. He saw an array of flashing lights that we would describe now as possibly have been on a computer of some kind. And he noticed as he was looking inside the object that his hand was getting very, very hot. Well, he pulled his head out and saw that his gloved hand, which was the glove was a rubberized material, which he was using when he was doing some rock collecting, so he protected his hands from rock chips. This rubberized material had actually melted. And he was, very, very surprised by this. As he stood there right next to the object, the door shut and the entire object began to rotate so that a grill or grid appeared in front of him like an exhaust vent. And as he stood there, a blast of hot gas shot out of this object, hit him in the chest, and set his clothes on fire and knocked him to the ground. The object took off and disappeared into the sky, but he was more concerned about putting out his clothes. Eventually, he ripped his shirt off and put it on the ground, stomped it out, and he was in considerable pain. He was also feeling very dizzy and nauseous, and he noticed that some of the pine needles and leaves in the area were also set on fire, so he stomped some of them out. But he was very, very dizzy, and he realized he probably should get some medical attention. So he proceeded to walk back to civilization, and again, this was an isolated area. It had taken him some time to get there. Walked back through the brush, eventually made it back to a motel. This was kind of a resort area, and waited for a bus to take him back to civilization. He eventually got back to Winnipeg, the largest city in Manitoba, where he was had been living. Was taken to a hospital where he was treated for second and third degree burns on his upper chest and released, but he felt that he should talk to somebody about this because this was a significant event. It was maybe an aircraft that was in trouble. Maybe it was a Russian invasion. He wasn't sure, so he told the media about it, and it became a media circus. It made the news right across the country. It made it the news made it down into the United States as well. In fact, the United States Air Force itself sent investigators up to take a look, interview Mr. Mihalik, and also to send a party out to the site to see if they could find any evidence. The Royal Canadian Air Force assisted, also the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and a number of other government agencies. They eventually did find the site after some time. It was a very isolated, difficult place to locate. They did find some of the burned pine needles and sort of a swept clean area where the gas must have blown everything away. They found his burned shirt. And the United States Air Force, in its own report on the case, classified it as unexplained, which is remarkable because it's a single witness case, and yet we have so much physical evidence that remains one of the most fascinating cases on record, not just in Canada, but certainly anywhere in the world. And a side note, they actually had found radiation at the site of such intensity that the Canadian government briefly considered closing off the entire provincial park. This would be the equivalent of closing off Yellowstone or Grand Teton to the public because of a fear for the public safety. They're actually considering that. And they took it so seriously that in order to try and find the source of the radiation, their opinion was maybe that somebody had seeded the area with radioactive material. The government actually sent investigators to known radioactive waste dumps and the storage facilities to see if anybody had broken in to take radiation or radioactive material out to dump it at this other particular space. So it was quite a remarkable case and investigated on a number of levels. In fact, through various Freedom of Information Act releases, we were able to get literally hundreds of pages of government documents about the case, and you know, it was taken very seriously by a number of government agencies at a number of levels, and yet there's no explanation. And Mr. Mihalik, to his dying days, and he died not that many years ago, insisted that this really occurred, and he didn't actually believe that it was an alien spaceship himself. He thought it was perhaps some sort of government weapon or government test vehicle, but it definitely occurred. We have no idea what this was. Unsolved Mysteries later flew me and Mr. Mihalik and his family down to recreate the case on the Unsolved Mysteries show. Had the opportunity to spend many, many hours with him and his family. A very honest person. In fact, he was taken to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota for not only a physiological examination, but a psychiatric examination. And the investigating psychiatrist concluded in his report that Mr. Mihalik is a very sound-minded individual and not prone to making things up. And if he said it was true, it was probably true. Again, one of the best cases that I can recall ever being involved with happened in 1967, not far from the American border, in an isolated part of Canada.
It affected his health quite a bit too, didn't it? He had like almost a checkerboard pattern of burns on his chest from this.
Right. One of the interesting effects was that there was a pattern on his chest of burns that seemed to match the shape and design of the grid that he described on the side of the object. In fact, his sketch of the object, which was made available to investigators by the Air Force since it had been turned over to them, shows almost identical match of the grill-like exhaust and the burns on his chest. And these were thermal burns, chemical burns of a sort, not radiation burns, but thermal burns. And these seem to reoccur from time to time. And even in his later years, if you put his hand on his chest, you could feel the scar tissue in this pattern on his lower abdomen. So, you know, he certainly endured something, and people who call it just a simple hoax really don't appreciate the extent to which this experience created physiological and physical effects. If somebody was to make a hoax, this is probably the best hoax ever on record, because he insisted it was real. He was seriously injured. There was damage to the environment. And again, the United States Air Force itself, taking everything into consideration, labeled the case unexplained.
I'm going to skip over. over the next section I was going to go into from the 70s. We've got about 12 minutes. I'd like to kind of go into your UFO survey that you talk about towards the end of the book.
Sure. Well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, if you'd like to explain what the survey is and how people also can participate by sending their Canadian information to you?
Sure. Yeah, and this, of course, is a Canadian study. There are similar efforts here and there around the world. There's nothing really coordinated for all of the United States. I know Peter Davenport does a remarkable job on his site, although he collects cases from around the world. But what we did, we wanted to really look at the cases from one particular country and do a really good analysis trying to figure out what exactly was seen. And so we looked at how many cases were reported per province. So again, the analogy would be, you know, how many cases from each state in the union. How many were red in color as opposed to yellow or green? How many were disc-shaped? How many were star-like? How many witnesses there were per case? How long they were seen for? How many occurred in the summer? How many at certain times of the day and so forth? And we did this across a number of years. Again, we started in 1989 rigorously doing this, and we're working on the 20th year this year right now for 2008. And every year since about 1995 or so, we noticed that the numbers were increasing dramatically, so that in about 1995 we were under 200 UFO reports, but then 1996 about 250, close to 300 in 1997, and continued to increase on a relatively constant scale with some fluctuations, to the point where as we got into the new millennium, 2000 we had almost 300 again, 2001 almost 400, almost 500 in 2002, and our peak so far was over 800, almost 900 in 2004. And last year, for 2007, we were very close to that number. In fact, we were our second highest number of UFO reports in 1 year. That's a lot of cases. That's more than two per day in the country, somewhere across the nation. And it's we obtain the reports not only directly from the individuals, but these are obtained from other researchers like myself and others across the country, and also from government. Since about 2000, I've been able to obtain regular government reports from the equivalent of the Federal Aviation Agency, through the equivalent of National Defense and so forth, so that we have a really good snapshot of what people in Canada really are seeing. And when you get that many cases, you can start to really understand what this whole phenomenon is all about and how broad it is and exactly what we're talking about.
How can people in Canada listening to us can get their reports to you?
Right now, people can send their reports to a website, which is and to an email, and the email is Canadian UFO Report, all one word, Canadian UFO Report at hotmail.com, and that gets to us, and we can use that data in a number of different ways.
Oh, excuse me. Oh, opened my mouth just thinking, almost choked. How did you get started in doing all of this, writing the books, investigating, setting up the survey? You know, what got you started?
Oh, that's that's an interesting story unto itself. I do have a couple of degrees in astronomy, as you mentioned, and in the 1970s at university, there were a lot of UFOs that were being seen at the time. Canada was in the midst of a wave. and not too far away from the place where I was taking my studies. And in astronomy, astronomers, of course, tend to be, as a whole, quite jaded and not really believers in the UFO phenomenon. And yet, the general public doesn't really know where to go for help and to get questions answered about the phenomenon. So people would be calling the astronomy department at the university wanting to report their UFOs. And my professors weren't that interested in talking to the people. They thought it was really nothing at all to worry about and didn't seem to have any interest whatsoever. But I was trying to get on the good side of my professors. So I offered to take those calls if any came in. And I ended up talking with a number of individuals and then going out to visit them in their homes, oftentimes many miles away in their farms, and found them to be, you know, quite rational people, that they weren't making things up. They had actually seen some remarkable things that I certainly couldn't explain. And then when I got back into the city, I was asked to talk about what I had heard, and gave a number of lectures and presentations, and then was asked to write about it. And some of these writings got published in a number of places, even in some fairly significant journals. And soon I found myself being the recipient of reports from not just my local area, but from right across Canada, to the point where I suppose I'm Canada's equivalent of Fox Mulder right now, that I get reports from not only the average citizen, but from other researchers and from the government about cases that are occurring throughout every month.
Oh, I think I would equate you a little closer to J. Allen Hynek myself.
Yes, well, actually I had the pleasure of knowing J. Allen Hynek quite a bit. He actually ended up sleeping over at my home when he came to visit here in Canada. And got to know him and Mimi and some of his family when they came up for an eclipse in 1979. I found him to be a fascinating individual. And, in fact, he was the one who encouraged me to set up a Canadian UFO organization, which Ufology Research of Manitoba, the group that I've maintained over the years since the 1970s. We've now shortened it to simply Ufology Research. And it's that organization that works on the Canadian UFO survey every year.
Oh, that is so cool. I would have said an individual I would have given my teeth to meet. He was a fascinating individual.
He was my mentor because, of course, I was an astronomer as well, and I really thought that astronomers would have a great deal of insight into what this whole phenomenon might be about, and certainly Hynek had a lot of insight into what was going on from his privileged position. Although astronomers, you know, may not necessarily be the ideal individual for understanding the universe, because maybe we're talking more in the realms of the humanities, social sciences, perhaps more physicists, meteorologists, and maybe even some exobiologists. So maybe just simply looking up into the sky isn't enough. It's the active involvement in what's really going on down here on Earth that's another key factor.
Oh, I agree. Hynek even at one time was asked to, kind of on the sly, ask all these different astronomers their opinions privately. And it was amazing that he came up with so many astronomers saying, well, you know, I think there might be something to this, but don't tell anybody I said so.
Absolutely. And there have been two notable studies of astronomers in terms of people who see UFOs. In fact, one of the major skeptics in science right now with regard to UFOs is Phil Plait. And he made a statement very recently that astronomers don't see UFOs, and they would be the ones to really see UFOs because astronomers are always looking up into the sky. And it turns out that pretty well everything in that statement is wrong. Astronomers do see UFOs. In fact, two studies, one by Peter Sturrock, who surveyed professional astronomers, and Gert Herb, who surveyed amateur astronomers, both found that about 5 to 6% of all astronomers, actively working astronomers, have seen UFOs, and some of them are quite remarkable cases. And the other thing is that, for the most part, astronomers don't necessarily look up into the sky and look through telescopes anymore. In fact, one of my own astronomy professors didn't look through a telescope during the last 15 years of his professional career because he was a theoretical astronomer. And even when astronomers do look into the sky, they're looking through telescopes at very discrete parts of the sky and may not even, you know, have a good appreciation of some of the constellations. It's a sad fact, but it's true. In fact, amateur astronomers probably spend more time looking up into the sky than professionals, and again, many of them do see UFOs, not necessarily the professionals.
Well, I agree. It's usually the amateur astronomers that are the ones that find all the new comets and meteors out there.
Indeed, it is amateur astronomers who find comets. In fact, one of my classmates was Ian Shelton, and he discovered the nearest supernova to our galaxy in 1987 and made the cover of Time magazine. So, and he was considered an amateur astronomer.
And there you go. A lot of mainstream scientists are too afraid to come forward with their ideas and their knowledge for fear of ridicule. And on that note, we need to go to a break. We'll be back here in a while on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network with Eye of the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, being broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. I'm DeAndrea. Tonight we're talking with Chris Rakowski. And if you'd like to send in a question for either Chris or myself, you can send them to eyetothesky@cox.net. That's E-Y-E, the number 2, thesky@cox.net. Or you can send them to me here in our virtual auditorium here in Pal Talk. You can either private message your question to me or even post them here in the auditorium. Also, you can listen to us on UFO Paranormal Radio Network by calling 704-631-4060 and entering the 4-digit station ID code 2899. And Chris, I wanted to get into your other book, your latest book, A World of UFOs. Both of these books are very interesting reads. They're an easy read, and you break them up in sections that are very easy to read as well. This is an awesome book. I don't think I've ever seen a book put together in grouped the way it is. It's very well done. What's your favorite case from the book A World of UFOs?
Oh, that's tough. Part of the reason I did this book the way it is people had come up to me and said, well, you know, you're writing a lot about Canada, but we know there's interesting cases around the world, and there's a lot of books about the American connection. What about cases elsewhere? Like, what about Australia? What about China? What about Japan? And so forth. And, you know, it's hard to get information out of some countries, although there are generally UFO groups and organizations, or at least a couple of investigators in pretty well every country around the world right now. And I have quite an extensive library of books related to UFOs, maybe a couple of thousand now. Also, you know, with the advent of the Internet, it's very easy to get information from all corners of the globe. So using resources, my contacts with individuals, and actually in some cases speaking with the individuals who had these experiences, from all around the world, I was able to put together a book talking about UFOs literally everywhere around the world, even in the Antarctic and the Arctic. The idea is to show that this really is a global phenomenon. It's not something that's particularly affecting Americans or the Brits or the Canadians. It's really something that's really around the world, and information is there. It's just not as well addressed, and I also give references to a lot of these publications so people can look them up as well, because I want really to have people appreciate the fact that this is a global phenomenon. And in terms of the, my favorite case from the book, I'd hate to be territorial and include another Canadian case. So even though I think it's a really good case, I won't talk about the one up in the Yukon. I'll let people read it. If in terms of the most interesting cases, one has to look probably at Father Gill. We alluded to it in the first half of our discussion. This is a very famous case that happened in 1958 and 1959. And it's been written about quite extensively and investigated very well. It's been the topic of a lot of discussion in many books. But to me, it really is a fascinating case. And in 1958, Father William Booth Gill, who was an Anglican priest, he was working as a missionary in Papua New Guinea. And there had been reports of lights in the sky throughout Indonesia, but he, wasn't sure what to make of them. He was just one of those things that he had heard about and wasn't spending too much time about. But in April of 1959, he saw a light on the side of a mountain, dismissed it as just one of those things, wasn't that interested in it. But it became more of interest to him a number of months later, when on June 26th, just after supper, about 6:45, he was standing outside the mission and saw a bright light in the northwest. Now, he noted that this bright object was above the planet Venus in the sky, which he had been watching the past few nights. He was an active stargazer. He called over to some of the other missionaries so they could watch it with them, and as they all watched, the more villagers joined them until more than 30 people were all looking at this object in the sky. And as they watched, it became apparent to them it was getting closer, and it got closer and closer until it appeared that it was almost overhead. And as it got closer, it turned out to be a disc-shaped object with four little legs on the underside, and on its sides were portholes, and on top was some sort of gangway or sort of a railing. And behind the railing, they could see a number of creatures, so humanoid figures. It was very hard to see because a very bright light was shining from this object. They watched it for quite some time. Moved a little bit. It disappeared in the clouds. But over the period of time, of the order of a couple of hours, a lot of people watched this. Well, the next night, it came back, and this crew was clearly visible on the upper deck, and some figures could be seen bending over as if they were sort of adjusting something or attending to something on top of the deck. And Father Gill decided to wave at one of these creatures who had its hands on a guardrail, and when he waved at it, he was very shocked to see this person or humanoid waved back. Another person watching with Father Gill waved at him too, and then a second figure waved back, and they started communicating back and forth with these occupants, waving and making gestures. He got a flashlight later, shone it in the direction of the craft, and in response, the entire craft seemed to move back and forth in kind of a pendulum motion. And then a beam of blue light shone out of the craft, although they weren't quite sure it was in response to their actions or not. But over the next couple of hours, they watched it intermittently, and it was so, common to them to watch it now because they had seen it the night before, that they decided to go inside and have dinner. Now, that might not be the typical response of you or I to seeing creatures on top of a flying saucer waving at us and communicating with us, but what else could they do? They decided to try and to continue normalcy, and it had remained in sight for a number of hours, so they went and had dinner, and of course when they came out, it had moved away a certain distance, but it was certainly still visible. And again, I have to emphasize, there were dozens of people who saw this object over the course of a few days. And, you know, Father Gill's reputation and integrity was never really called into question because there were so many people who had watched it with him. And just imagine, you know, in this fairly isolated part of the world, a flying saucer of some sort being visible and being observed to such an extent that creatures themselves were seen. And back in the late 1950s, there were some reports like this in circulation that were very fantastic. This was the contactee era, and yet Father Gill wasn't looking for notoriety. He certainly was looking at this very scientifically. He reported to his superiors what had happened in a very matter-of-fact fashion and stated, this is what happened, this is what we all watched, and a lot of witnesses were interviewed. In fact, investigators who later talked with Father Gill, he actually came to the United States later on and was interviewed by Hynek and others. They found him to be a very solid individual. At one point, Phil Klass had said that Gill had been watching Venus and wasn't using his glasses and so forth, and Gill was able to refute those claims quite easily. But we have another classic case happening in a part of the world that's quite isolated, but one of the more interesting cases that's on record.
I have to admit that, yes, the Father Gill case is an incident that I have found fascinating, again, since I was a kid. But I found that your book, your section in this book, had a lot more information in it than any other, or, you know, about the case, than any other publication that I've read about, you know, this particular incident.
Well, I did research it quite extensively. I didn't rely on just one publication or another. I went back, even though Phil Klass believed it to have been just Venus. I wanted to research and get what information he had and find out if there are any details that he had in his publications and his books that others didn't have. Jerry Clark of QFOS was invaluable in getting the information. I did go to the Lorenzans had it included as well. And, you know, it's just a matter of trying to track down as much information as possible. In fact, that was possibly the trickiest part of putting together this book. There is so much information out there, not just in books and magazines, but now on the Internet. To try and put it all together into a coherent fashion and try and sift through a coherent story is very, very difficult. Even just talking about Roswell sometimes makes people's heads explode because there's just so much information, so many witnesses, so many parts of the story that it's difficult to really come up with an accurate timeline or a sensible timeline for what really happened and who said what and what happened where.
Exactly. A lot of the accounts that I've read just was a quick rundown of what the sighting was, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question here from Gossamer777, and he asks, have there been any other multiple witness mass U events in Canada besides the Shag Harbor case? And if yes, did you do any investigation on them?
Yes, there have been a number of mass UFO events. In fact, one that comes to mind, and just bear with me while I pull up my notes on it, happened in Montreal. Pull it up here. In 1990, November 1990, very interesting, over downtown Montreal. This would be, Montreal's quite a large city, would be the equivalent of something being seen over, let's say, downtown St. Louis. Many guests at the International Hilton Bonaventure Hotel were enjoying a fairly nice evening, although it was November and quite cold. Many people were still out, and they had a heated pool on top of the hotel, and it's a very nice view up there. About 7:15, some people observed a very odd object in the sky over the hotel. It was oval light of some sort that she contacted the lifeguard, who watched it and contacted hotel security. And then pretty well everybody started watching this. The police were called out. The airport was advised, and then reporters were called to the scene as well. It seemed to be getting brighter. There were three stationary lights. Some moved in the sky. There were typically, witnesses described, 3 to 9 lights, either in a circular or an oval pattern. They were described as white, although some referred to them as having yellow, blue, or reddish tints. Rays of light shone out from the lights, seemingly ending as if they were truncated as opposed to simply fading out. And this was reported by, again, seen and reported not only by people, you know, dozens of people on top of the Hotel Bonaventure, but also police and security guards. And they checked with the airport and found out that there were no flights over the hotel at the time. Later, there was an attempt to explain it as the Northern Lights, but photographs that were taken show that it's definitely not the Northern Lights. It was definitely a structured pattern of lights that was in the sky that was seen by many people. So that's a very interesting mass witness case that hasn't really adequately been explained. You know, I include details of it in the Canadian UFO report.
In your book, you have it on the first three sections are the five most famous UFO cases, the five most bizarre, and the five most interesting.
Right.
The listing for the five most famous is the Roswell crash, Betty and Barney Hill, the Rendlesham Forest, the Tehran incident, and the Phoenix Lights.
Yeah,
I think out of those five, the one that people know the least about is the Tehran Air Force pilot's sighting.
Right. And what made me choose it was that it was very well documented. It involved Air Force personnel and wasn't investigated quite well. It was included, I have to point out, that Paul Kimball and a number of other individuals have put together lists of the top 10, and there have been top 10 cases that have been described on some UFO specials on TV over the past few years. And Tehran has made a number of people's top 10. It happened in September of 1976, early in the morning, when the Imperial Iranian Air Force was contacted by a civilian airport at Mehrabad, which is very near Tehran, regarding calls from citizens about UFO sightings over the capital. Now, I have to point out that the Imperial Iranian Air Force had been trained by the United States Air Force, and a lot of the equipment was obtained from them. One person who had called the airport described the object as a kind of a bird, and actually one resident asked the airport to tell the helicopter with a light on it to get away from their house. Not surprisingly, according to the Air Force, there were no helicopters in the area at the time. Now, a brigadier general, who is an assistant deputy commander of operations at the base, contacted tower operators and determined the object had been reported but was not on any air defense radar screen. And yet the brigadier general himself went outside and saw a large, bright object that he thought was quite odd. So he ordered the scrambling of an F-4 fighter jet from an Air Force base that was about 150 miles southwest of Tehran to investigate. Now, it took off about 1:30 and headed north, and even flying at Mach 1, the pilot was unable to close in on it. But as he reached a point of about 25 miles away from the target, he lost all communications with the base. Now, he broke off his pursuit of the target and turned back towards the base. And when he came back on a path heading for home, his communications came online again. Now, about a month later, a transcript of a tape recording of the pilot's conversation with the control tower was released, and the operator had told the pilot to return home if he was unable to close in on the target. And when he turned to go back, he told the tower that something was coming at me from behind at 50 miles away, now 10 miles, now 5 miles. It's level. I think it's going to crash into me. And then he said, it has just passed by, missing me narrowly. And then the tower then guided the pilot, who was quite agitated, back to the base. A second F-4 was sent out, and this time the radar on the jet aircraft got a lock on that object and closed on it at a very high speed. And when the pilot had closed to within about 25 miles, it moved away at a very strong pace, but judging from the size of the radar return, the object was estimated to be about the size of a Boeing 747 tanker aircraft with very, very dazzling lights. So this went on for some time. There were a number of other objects were seen. The pilots were interrogated. There, at one point, an object was seen to have landed. They traveled by helicopter the next morning to where they thought the object had landed. They tried to talk to people on the ground to see if they had seen anything, but nobody on the ground had seen anything. This case was discussed at length by Phil Klass, who disputed the possibility that perhaps the aircraft radar was malfunctioning, perhaps the pilots were just mistaken, they were disoriented. From an analysis of what the pilots had reported and through some of the transcripts, those explanations really didn't stand up as well as they could have. So for that reason, and the fact that it really had a lot of details, radar detection, visual observation, pilots in the air being scrambled to take a look at it, I ranked it as one of the five most famous cases around the world. Again, this is not necessarily a strictly one country book. This was in a world of UFOs, and I really wanted to get a flavor for the UFOs that were most famous around the world.
And interesting enough, the pilot of the second F-4 was at the news conference that Leslie Kane put together here a year ago this month.
Oh, I see. I wasn't aware of that. How did he sound?
Very good. His English was very good as well. And he told of his incident, what had happened, and I thought he was very well received. I was surprised, considering the tensions between Iran and the United States, that they allowed him to, of course, he's now retired, but that they would allow him to come here and talk about it.
Yeah, and I think what is significant there, too, is that because this is a worldwide phenomenon, I think that people all around the world have an interest in the subject, and it's led to a lot of puzzles and mysteries from one corner of the globe to the other. So to me, the fact that we have individuals from Iran or from China or from Argentina or from wherever talking about their experiences and sharing their own experiences really shows that we're dealing with a real worldwide global phenomenon.
Exactly. The next section was the most bizarre. And to tell you honest truth, I have a hard time picking which one to talk about from this section because I'm familiar with all five of them. There's the Kelly Hopkinsville Close Encounter, which I've interviewed the daughter of one of the men involved in that case here on this show. Joe Simonton's Pancakes, the Tully Saucer Nest, Antonio Villas-Boas, and the Manhattan abductions. Gosh, it's really hard to choose which one to talk about in this section.
Right, and again, this is the most bizarre cases, and they have elements that are just strange. As if reports of UFOs and the possibility of alien craft isn't bad enough, but when you get cases that really stretch the imagination, and yet there is a lot of physical evidence in some cases, factual evidence that really suggests something bizarre and more than just your average alien visitation was involved. Joe Simonton's Pancakes really exemplifies this well when Simonton in Wisconsin was looking out his farm house when he saw an object land. It was egg-shaped on some legs, and he walked up to it, and inside through an open door he could see a number of creatures that appeared to be cooking on a grill of some sort, and they asked him in sign language for some water, and he went and got a pitcher full of water and gave it to them, and in return for his kindness that they had been cooking on this. And, you know, he, again, insisted that this was real. He wasn't making it up, and he even made pancakes or griddle cakes, or you know, some people even describe them as cookies, available for analysis. In fact, the United States Air Force took one of them and gave it to the Food and Drug Administration, or what was called the Food and Drug Administration, the equivalent back then, to analyze it. And they found it to be a very, very healthy, high-fiber, high-grain pancake or griddle cake at the time. In fact, these days we'd call them very diet-conscious aliens.
I've got a question that's going around here in the auditorium asking if you find the Manhattan abduction case credible.
Well, I find it bizarre, and you know, I've read through the material. There's just so many bizarre elements to it that seem to really stretch the imagination to the point of breaking. Whether Dan really existed, whether it was all some sort of made-up fabrication for one reason or another. I mean, the story kept on changing and getting more involved about some of the individuals involved in the case being snagged in plain view off the street, about the possibility that Xavier de Cuellar with the United Nations may have been the official involved. And actually, there's a Canadian connection because, as it turns out, that the Canadian Prime Minister at the time was meeting with the UN Commissioner and might have been involved, too. I actually inquired about that and didn't get very far. It's such a bizarre case that I personally find it very difficult to believe, and yet a lot of people really support Linda Curtiel and her... some of the other individuals, like her husband and so forth. But, you know, I just find it very, very difficult to believe. So I won't come out and say that I believe it's a hoax, but I find it very, very difficult to believe it. And I have read Garfield Reeves Stevens' Night Eyes and do find the similarities between the case. I doubt that it was actually patterned after it. That would be far too simple in my mind, but it really stretches the imagination to put all this together. I think the problem is that the story got more and more elaborate and changed as the weeks and months went on, that it just became more difficult to believe.
I have an email here from Kelly in Florida, and Kelly asks, I had heard that you and several other people had started an abductee support group. Have you had many people becoming a part of this group, and have they found this outlet helpful in dealing with their experiences?
Well, we actually had formed a support group. My book previous to the Canadian UFO Report, which is available, as I understand, at Walmart and Barnes & Noble, was called Abductions and Aliens. It should be available in the stores right now. It dealt with abduction cases around the world. And I got involved by individuals coming up to me after my talks and approaching me privately about their own experiences, that I felt compelled to study it, even though as an astronomer I felt quite inadequate in trying to understand what was going on. So I ended up working with a clinical psychologist who happened to use hypnosis in his practice. It was actually used very sparingly. It wasn't as prevalent as a lot of abductee researchers do. I formed the support group because so many people had come to me, and I had heard good things about similar groups that had been operating in the United States, that I formed it. I got the individuals involved, connected with one another, and then backed off because, again, I'm not a clinical psychologist. I can't really act as a resource for the experiences. In fact, my concern is that ufologists in general are not suited for abductee research as well. I tell you the reason for that is because at least a half dozen individuals who approached me regarding some abduction experiences either had some very serious psychological problems or really had a lot of red flags going. At least two of them had attempted suicide. One woman who I had worked with, we got past the interview stages and got into some sessions, and then was in the process of referring her to the clinical psychologist for hypnosis. It turned out that she had been raped, and that this might have been a screen memory for her experiences. So that led me to think that individuals who, not everyone, who was reporting abduction experiences, but certainly enough of them have experiences and elements that suggested that something else was going on or in addition to their abduction experiences. And I felt compelled ethically to refer them to clinicians, not because I thought they were crazy or unbalanced or anything, but because there were some other things going on. Some individuals were clearly depressed. Some individuals showed a very high degree of anxiety, and I thought that it was proper to refer a number of individuals to clinical psychologists and really transferred the whole thing over to the abductees themselves in terms of the group, but making sure that they had all the necessary resources available for seeking help regarding personal issues. So it was interesting, and I still do get individuals coming to me from time to time regarding their abduction experiences. But it's really a completely different kettle of fish than investigating what I would describe as nuts and bolts flying saucer cases. I've had a military officer come into my office and say that he believed that he had been abducted by aliens, and he wasn't really in a position to tell his commanding officer what had occurred. Lord knows the military has enough things on its plate right now without that as well. And so I worked with him briefly as well. I talk about his experience in that book, Abductions and Aliens, as well. And I've had a nurse come to me with a fascinating case that about how she came home one day after a series of shifts and found two small creatures in her living room, not the classic almond-eyed, oval-shaped faces, but round-headed creatures with round eyes and long flowing robes that were more reminiscent of the contactees than the abductees. And her case was very fascinating, and I really couldn't come to any conclusion about that experience either. So I worked with a number of individuals. There's still individuals coming to me, and when I can provide some help, but my best advice right now for abductees who approach me is to seek help regarding anxiety, or if it's affecting relationships, maybe go to counselors or therapists, because I think ufologists in some cases are probably hindering the cause rather than helping it.
I agree, and I applaud your efforts. I really do. Since we're on the subject of abductions, why don't we talk a little bit about Antonio Villas-Boas, whose case predates Betty and Barney Hill.
Indeed. Antonio Villas-Boas is one of the classic cases in UFO literature, and threw a little bit of sex into the mix as well. It was on October 15th in 1957 when farmer Antonio Villas-Boas was plowing a field, and 1 o'clock in the morning he noticed a very odd red-colored star in the sky. And during the previous evening, while he was working the field, he and his brother had observed a number of objects. But this time, this unusual star-like object appeared to come closer and got bigger and bigger and bigger, very similar to what Mr. Mihalik had happened to him as well. But this object took up a position about 150 feet over his head. It looked egg-shaped and cast a bright pinkish light around his tractor. Now, Antonio had thought about running away, but the object had proven the night before, he had tried chasing it in the tractor, that it could move faster than he could run or indeed drive. And of course it was too late by then. The object dove from its position and landed only about 35 feet away from the tractor. He saw it was definitely oval-shaped with three kind of spurs arranged as a tripod in which it rested and a lighted rotating ring on top. Now, Tony admitted that he was kind of freaked out. He tried to drive off, but the tractor's engine quit. He then opened the door that was on the other side from the craft and tried to get outside, but a small creature in a strange uniform grabbed him from behind. He shoved the being away and tossing it several feet, but as soon as he made another dash for safety, he encountered three more creatures, and eventually, in sheer number, they overpowered him and managed to carry him to the craft and through a door in its side. Now, once inside, he was dumped in kind of a small room with shiny metal walls and a ceiling. It seemed to be sort of fluorescent lights along a wall. Five of the creatures were restraining him, and he was guided through a doorway into a larger room. There were some stools, and there were some support beams inside, but he was really trapped. He was trapped like a caged animal, which is a bit ironic because he said that these creatures spoke to one another in sort of dog-like grunts and barks and growls. They were in seamless one-piece diving suits, gray in color. They had helmets that were attached with metallic plates, and they had eye coverings that looked like goggles. He didn't really get a good look of what they looked like. They stopped talking at one point, having come to a decision, and started taking his clothes off of him. He fought them off, but nevertheless ended up in his birthday suit. And to make matters worse, one of them approached him with a soft cloth and gave him a sponge bath and some sort of thick, clear, odorless liquid. He was then led over towards the door and taken into yet another room. Now, inside, they applied some pipes or round tubular objects and attempted to suck some blood out of his body, and then was left to himself. He was feeling nauseous. There was an unpleasant smell in the room, and there were puffs of smoke or some sort of colored gas being emitted from tubes located along the top of the walls. And he was so sick, he actually vomited in a corner of the room. Now, he lost consciousness, or otherwise lost track of time, and was startled awake by the door opening. And looking up, he saw the unmistakable figure of a naked woman approaching him with a very curious expression on her face. Now, Antonio described her as beautiful, but not quite human. She had long, silver blonde hair that looked like if it had been bleached and parted in the center. Her eyes were almond-shaped and extended quite far around the side of her face. She had high cheekbones, an oval face with a small nose and a pointed chin. Now, he described her visual anatomy as that of a well-developed human female. She was a little shorter than him, and she had a lot of freckles, but otherwise seemed very human. And she moved towards him and immediately made it very clear what she wanted. Well, we'll sort of skip over those details. Suffice to say that the experience ended, and she exited the room, and when she turned back to him, she pointed her towards her belly and then up, which he interpreted as meaning that she would return to take him with her to her home. When she left, the other creatures came back in, gave him his clothes, told him to get dressed, in other words, and get out. And he was taken back outside the craft and dumped, and the ship took off again. And he was left to sort of shake his head and be very dazed by his experience.
And he later went on to become a successful attorney.
Right. He actually had a quite a good reputation. He was he kept to himself for many years. Really didn't accept very many interviews. He was a practicing lawyer. He was married. He really didn't discuss his experience in any detail, even with his family. But until his death, he maintained his experience had been real, and he didn't make up any of it. He didn't use the story to gain profit or fame, and you know that these days it sounds really much like a script for a good Hollywood movie. The case was investigated by Dr. Olavo Fontes of Rio de Janeiro. Brought it to the attention of APRO. Fontes had examined Villas-Boas was puzzled by a story and the physiological symptoms, and it was a very bizarre case, and yet, you know, Antonio insisted that it happened just the way he described it. And his family, even his family, his brothers at the time had said, yeah, if Antonio says it happened, it must have happened. So again, in parallel in some ways to the case of Stefan Mihalik, a single individual case, which are considered not necessarily the best cases, and yet it's a fascinating story that that doesn't, you know, really have an explanation of any kind at this point.
Let's see, we've got about 9 minutes to go, or excuse me, this changed to 8 minutes to go. I'd like to, if possible, cover some of the incidences that happened in the Antarctic. I found that section really fascinating.
Okay. Let me just quickly flip here. Let's see. In 1965, British and American officials on Deception Island in Antarctica saw odd colored lights over their base moving around for periods up to 30 minutes. On July 3rd, 1965, at 7:20 p.m., nine scientists and technicians at Aguirre Cerda on Chile, a Chilean Antarctic base, watched a light move from east to west in the sky low in the horizon. It seemed to have a solid appearance like a celestial body, and flew on a trajectory with oscillations. 20 minutes later, seven personnel saw another object, this time oval-shaped with intensity brighter than a first-magnitude star. They watched it for more than an hour and watched it move above the stratus, all while flashing different colors. In an official report, officers insisted the object was not a hallucination and that testimonies of the personnel were valid. While the object was in sight, instruments on board an Argentine Navy ship were affected by some kind of magnetic field. The commander of the Chilean base stated, "It is rash to say that we all saw a flying saucer like those in science fiction, but nevertheless, it was something real, an object traveling at staggering speed. As far as I'm concerned, it is a celestial object that I am unable to identify. That it could be an aircraft constructed on this Earth, I do not believe possible." You know, this comes from a military official. So that's one example of one of the cases from Antarctica that I record in the book.
Cool. I've got an off-topic question here from you, or for you, from my husband.
Okay.
He says here that he read that you have been a member of the avant-garde jazz group, the Experimental Creative Music Workshop. And he was curious if you still performed with them, and also what instrument or instruments do you play?
Well, as a matter of fact, yes, I'm still officially on the books as a member of the group, Experimental Creative Music Workshop. I haven't performed with them for about, maybe a year and a half. Things seem to take up a lot of time, but at one point I was performing in concerts around our province, and really enjoying it. And I was playing, keyboards. I'd be playing piano and synthesizer, but also would shift over to drums and percussion, playing vibes and marimba. And I also taught myself some basic flute. So kind of a multifaceted in that regard, and I really enjoy doing that. It's a way to express oneself in a very different fashion than my writing.
A man of many talents.
Yes. I have an interesting case that's not in the book that I thought I would share.
Oh, cool.
With you. And some of you may have heard of it. In fact, I remember reading about this too. This happened in Greenland. This happened on the 24th of June, 1953. And the reason I mention this is that I recently came across the official military document about this case when going through some files, some official files through the National Archives of Canada. This happened 24th of June, 1953, and at a around, let's see now, 1430 Zulu, so somewhere around 10 o'clock in the morning, an Air Force weather observer, and I'm reading from this report here, with 3.5 years experience, saw an object through a theodolite. Now, a theodolite is a small telescope-like device that meteorologists use to track weather balloons. So a weather balloon had been sent up, and this is over Simiutak, Greenland. So just imagine, quite a cold, snowy area, even in the 24th of June. Sent up a weather balloon, was watching it through his theodolite, and then saw an object through the theodolite near the balloon, and the object was traveling southeast to northwest at varied speeds, approximately 3.5 miles distant from the base. The object was described as red and rotating, with a shape as either delta or circular. Again, I'm just reading from the report, and this is what I find interesting. Right from the report, the object collided with the weather balloon at approximately 18,000 feet, disintegrating the balloon. The theodolite was the only method of observation. The size of the object was stated to be 3 times that of the weather balloon. The object hovered after collision in a circular motion for 15 seconds and then rapidly departed into the wind at a speed which could not be calculated. After collision, the object was quickly gone from sight. This is a quote from an official military document for 24th of June, 1953. An Air Force meteorologist saw a large object collide with a weather balloon, destroying the weather balloon, hovered for a few seconds or so, and then took off against the wind.
Yeah, it must have been a pretty good-sized object, as it was described, because a weather balloon, when they at that time when they filled them up, they would be approximately 6 feet across, and then expand
least,
as they go up.
That's right, and the odds of something colliding with it, or maybe it was on purpose, were remarkable. And I remember reading about this story. I'm not sure whether it was a Frank Edwards book or somebody else's, maybe even a valet book, but I remember hearing the story, but it was fascinating for me to actually uncover the original document that the report comes from. And again, a fascinating case, this one over Greenland, to show you that, that this is really a world of UFOs. I'd like to add before we run out of time that as a special bonus for readers of the book, there is a website which was set up by the publisher. That is Dundurn, dundurn.com, so that's dundurn.com/UFOs. And if your listeners or readers of the book go to that, they'll see a website, which is a UFO blog. On that website, I have not only some photographs, which are not included in the book, but I have additional information on recent cases. There's ways of reporting UFOs, UFO experiences yourself. Plus, we're starting to work on video blogs and all that sort of stuff. So there's additional photographs, new cases, photographs that supplement the information that's included in the book, and ways of really getting in touch with what's really going on in the field of ufology these days. Again, that website is dundurn.com/UFOs. That's D-U-R-N, sorry, dundurn.com/UFOs. And that gets to a web blog called The UFO Report, and that's one of the blogs that I maintain.
And where can they find the Canadian UFO Report and A World of UFOs at?
Both books, Canadian UFO Report and World of UFOs, are available through Amazon, and I understand that Barnes & Noble has an earlier book of mine called Abductions and Aliens. And if you Google me, Chris Rutowski, you'll find out a lot more information, and I seem to be all over the place.
And for your UFO study report, where can they report their sightings to again?
People can report sightings on the Canadian side to Canadian UFO Report at hotmail.com, and there is a website where we actually have all the data listings for every single case that was reported, and last year there was more than 800 cases reported, and that is at survey.canadianuforeport.com. And we have information on that going back to 1989. Every single UFO report is listed in one form or another, and there's analysis on things like time of day that most UFOs are seen, which provinces had more reports than others, the prevalent colors, the prevalent shapes, which ones were nocturnal lights, which ones were daylight discs, and which ones are unexplained versus ones that turn out to have possible or insufficient information. It's quite an interesting analysis. There really isn't anything like it that's comparable, and at this point we're looking at several thousand UFOs which we've been documenting just in one country. It'd be nice to see other countries doing it. In fact, I've heard that both Italy and Sweden have somewhat similar analysis that is available, because they include things as well as government files in addition to the civilian reports. So we have cases not only reported by the average listener, but cases that come through official channels. In fact, I'll share with your listeners to show how this works. November 27th at 23:17 Zulu, that's Greenwich time, an orange flash was seen by Halifax. Relayed from Halifax from a helicopter returning inbound to Halifax Airport, reporting a large orange flash on the horizon. And it says here that Transport Canada, which is the equivalent of the FAA in Canada, was investigating. You know, the helicopter was inbound from a oil platform off Nova Scotia, saw an orange flash on the horizon. There was no tail or stream. The aircraft was at 2,500 feet and on a relative bearing of 220 degrees. And this was seen, again, November 27th, so just a matter of a few days ago. So we get these reports from official channels. We include it in the civilian data, or with the civilian data as well, so we get a picture of what people really are seeing from one end of the country to the other.
Oh, that's fascinating, but unfortunately, we are all out of time. I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and I want to thank Chris for joining us tonight, and I want to thank all of those who joined us in the Pal Talk Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. And please join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Skies, a UFO Synopsis, when my guest will be Robert Emmenager. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone. And we're clear.
Well, great.